Hello, my name is Mr. Burns. I believe you have a letter for me.
Okay, Mr. Burns. What's your first name?
I don't know.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast. We are back for another week. We're talking mailbag this week. I'm Rob Calder, joined by Nick Mihai. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Great drop, by the way.
Thank you very much. It's the highlight of my week, honestly, going through old Simpsons episodes and trying to find those. Brenton O'Brien, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Fantastic to have you both in. Just a reminder, as always, if you have any coach shout-outs, topics, or anything like that you would like to send in, you are always welcome to send those in throughout the course. We did throw a story out on Instagram this week for anyone that wanted to have anything specific on the mailbag, and we are going through those questions today. So we've got about 8 questions, I think it is, overall that we can get through. Various levels of degrees of difficulty on some of these. Some of these are some curly ones that we're going to have to really think about. Some of these we can just give advice on, which is always helpful as well. Brenton, you are probably the closest person to being under the age of 18 in this room. So the first question we have had come in is, any advice for a young coach, so under the age of 18, on how to develop properly and what they should be focusing on as a coach?
That is a tough one. I know when I started coaching, I started when I was 17. I remember going to my first Pacific Coast Slam, and I think the best thing...
What was a Pacific Coast Slam, for those that aren't old enough to remember that?
So I remember going on a bus trip for about however long it is to get to Port Macquarie, and I was sitting next to a coach from Geelong who's not with us anymore, Rod Boone, who was a massive influence on me. I still remember sitting there and having to stop at Albury, stop at a few other places, but... Yep. I think that was a part of my development there. Like, I got to go on these trips. I got to go to these environments where I got to just be a sponge and listen and learn. And I think the biggest piece of advice I'd give to a coach that is under 18 is just get involved where you can and just soak it all up. Like, you're at that point where you can just go and observe things and see what's happening and kind of develop what you believe. But it's also a good opportunity to just get involved and really see if you love it.
Yeah. Well, it's a good environment, I think, to make mistakes.
Yep.
Like, people are very accommodating of people under the age of 18 that screw things up. And it's like, oh, they're young. Like, and, you know, they'll fix it for you and that sort of thing. So I think there's an element of, like, throw yourself out there. Like, try and get involved somewhere that's going to test you a little bit. Like, but don't skip steps. And, you know, it's a bit of a broken record on the pod, obviously. But, you know, the reps don't lie. You've got to be really careful that you're not trying to go from an under 18 coach to, you know, I want to be the Boomers and the Opals head coach within 10 years. It's like, well, good luck. Like, that doesn't work that way. And I think the biggest thing is, like, I like the fact that you put yourself out there with the experience. And it's like, well, go and surround yourself with people that have been there before and done it before and find out what you can learn from them. Because, I mean, like, Rod was a fantastic giver to the sport in general. Like, we'd always coach teams. Sometimes you sit there and go, mate, what are you doing coaching that team? And they're like, oh, they needed a coach. So I jumped in and coached them.
Yeah,
like,
you loved it, didn't you?
It was just that kind of guy that would do those sorts of things. So those people want to help. And that's the biggest thing that I've learned over the years, I think, is there are so many coaches that are willing contributors to other people's success that will help them out as best they possibly can. Like, Nick, what do you remember of sort of coming through that? Obviously, you had a playing career that went straight into coaching. Were you coaching under the age of 18 at any stage?
I wasn't coaching under the age of 18, so if you're playing, that definitely helps. Yep. I think it's the same thing. Be a sponge and ask questions. Like, find there's always someone that is quite knowledgeable in your area these days. In Victoria, we're quite expansive as well. And it is just as simple as getting reps in. Like, it is just that simple. Like, if there's tournaments and parents are willing, like, entering tournaments and play 4 or 5 games, and that's where the learning comes from. That's where you do the trial and error. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. Don't think that you have to be this type of coach right now. Just experience. And the biggest advice I would give is find your personality as a coach. Like, I think that's so important. If you could do that under the age of 18, you are way ahead of a lot of coaches your age, if not all of them.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of the time coaches try to replicate other coaches, like, take their information, respect what they have to say, but add your personality to it. That's the biggest advice I could give them.
Yeah, and it's like, I remember, because I was coaching under the age of 18, like, and I was one of those suckers, for lack of a better term, that would coach like 4 domestic teams on a Saturday. Like, I'd bounce from the Green Hills Beavers to Diamond Creek Creekers to the St. Thomas Hawks, I think they were at the time, and then I picked up like a Watsonia Heights Warriors team during the week. Like, it was just, I enjoyed coaching, but I also knew that my playing experience wasn't enough to get me by. And I needed to go and experience. And that was all different age groups. Like, that was under 10s, that was under 14s, that was under 18s. And it was just a way of getting more reps in and trying to find out, well, what am I? Like, am I better with 12s? Like, do I like that better than when I coach under 18s? And, you know, you'll find your own. I'm really hesitant to say you need to be a boys or a girls coach or you need to be this age group or anything like that, because I think the good coaches can coach wherever.
And it also changes.
Oh, big time.
Like, Rob, back in the day, you were probably like, no, I'm 18s. And now you would probably go back and go, I'm under 12s.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like, so it does change as well. Yeah. So don't pigeonhole yourself.
I think we all go through it at times, I think, as coaches too. We get enamored with the X's and O's and the technical, tactical sort of stuff. And it's like, well, I can't really do the X's and O's stuff with like under 12 kids. So you want to be pushed and challenged. And of course, you look at the under 18s and it's like, well, there's probably the more talented players up there. So I want to go and coach up there because they will test me as a coach, and I can do some things tactically, I can impact on games and those sorts of things, whereas the younger age groups, you can't. But the younger age groups gives you that beautiful ability to really have that learning check of, is what I'm saying making sense? And is my audience actually hearing it, or am I being really flippant? Because it's really easy coaching under 18s. Your language can just be like three or four words. You know, they'll just clear their own, yeah, I've heard that before. Like, no problems, I know what you're talking about. Whereas an under 12 kid will look at you and just go, I have no idea what you're talking about. Just let me dribble the ball to the right-hand sideline and that's all I really want to do for this game. Like, you've got to be careful of pigeonholing yourself into one spot. And I think that's the challenge with a lot of coaches and you've got to be careful that coaching doesn't become your identity. There's got to be something outside the coaching. I think coaching is phenomenal. And I would say the same with refereeing. In developing life skills in general. Like, I would recommend everybody that is not doing a referees or an officials course, go and do one. Like, you don't have to become a ref out of it, but go and actually learn it for a starter. It'll make you a better coach. But in terms of developing your communication skills, in terms of understanding what leadership looks like and where it is, go and ref and coach. Like, if you're under that age, like, that'll serve you so well in the future because you have to deal with adults, but you also have to deal with kids. You have to find where you fit within that and what your personality type is. But if you live and breathe it, which is great, like we love people that do, just make sure there is an outlet, because that's the danger of being so consumed with basketball. Like, you're a mountain biker.
Yeah, I tried to be, and that obviously didn't end well when my bike went missing. But yeah, that's something I did especially during...
Sorry, no, you're going to have to wind that back.
Story time.
I think I hit two buttons at the same time. That's a little bit of book club.
Hello.
Let's roll with it.
I'm going with it.
And my apartment smells of rich mahogany.
Have you read any books lately as well, Brenton, as we go through this?
No, I haven't actually.
Okay. No, anyway, back to your bike being stolen.
It's not that great a story, to be honest. I remember moving in with my now housemate who, first night I got there and I literally put my bike in this one corner and it was sitting behind a car where you couldn't see it, and the next morning wasn't there. And I'm just shattered because, like, there's the one thing I used to go mountain biking all the time, especially during COVID. It was just a really good outlet for me. Like, I was lucky enough that I had my mum's house, so I went back to Geelong, which was regional, where I was able to do things. So it was really good. But, like, I think that was one of the best things for me. Like, I know COVID was tough for a lot of people, but for me it would really help me, like you said, find something outside of basketball. So now it's like, now I'm probably moving more towards the gaming side, which probably isn't the most healthy choice, but
no, I'm on board.
I'm also on board.
Especially with this new Pokemon games being new released. Now I'm in a bit of trouble, so.
It is dangerous, I must admit.
It was definitely a heartbreaking moment for me when that went missing, but I actually am looking for a new one at the moment. So
excellent.
Just trying not to spend too much money.
No, well, that's probably fair, and, you know, maybe invest in a lock. Might be the other thing you could potentially look at.
Yeah, very smart.
Yeah, but I think that's valuable. Like, and it is something that's still active, health-related, that gets you away from the basketball stuff. And your mind would probably still wander there at times, like when you're off on the bike and those sorts of things, and you still start thinking about your coaching and everything that goes with it. Like, I do that every morning on a walk. I normally link back into an email I haven't replied to or, you know, something I was supposed to do, or how can we apply what I've seen to, like, our coaching framework, those types of things. But I think that's healthy, like, because you're not intently focusing on something. It's just like, well, if your mind wanders there, your mind wanders there. That's okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like, for me, I know I get caught up in things, like, a lot. Like, I kind of, it's like nearly overwhelming because we're so engaged and so invested in what we're doing. So I think even walking for me does that. Like, I go for a walk nearly every morning and I'll just go for like an hour and a half, and it's just the best time for me to clear my head. So just another thing, like, it doesn't have to be a massive hobby. It can just be something, you know, that works for you. And going for a walk, or even just going down to a cafe, I do that too. If I can sit in a place like that, that can help my head and make sure that I'm not just focusing on basketball all the time.
When he's walking, he's looking around at everyone that rides past on a bike. It's like, is that my bike?
Is that
do I have to chase them down?
Literally.
Like, where did you get that?
I can imagine.
Now, the walking's a big one, though. Like, it really, I think a lot of us are doing that these days, right? It's a great way to clear the head.
Yeah, the other thing that I want people aware of, and Sarah Wall's done a great job here at Basketball Victoria putting this together as well, is we do have some guidelines for supporting coaches who are under the age of 8 or 18. I'll put the link up to that in the show notes as well for those of you that want to have a little bit of a look at it. And it's just some best practice things, that things that you may not be aware of, things we probably take for granted when we've got, say, a 16, 17-year-old coach as opposed to an adult coach in that sort of space. So I'll put the link to that in the show notes because Sarah's done a lot of work with that, and I think it's a really good resource for people involved in that space. And next question is, how can you get involved or help out at Skills Days and the Under 12 Jamboree? So again, I'll put the link to the Skills Days in the show notes on this one. Skills Days, what do they involve, Brenton? Just for those that might be curious about jumping into it.
So the Skills Days, where we have under 14s or under 12s come into a camp session with us for a day. Like, they have their hubs. Like, I remember when I was back in Geelong, I was running the one in Colac, and that was awesome. I would highly recommend it for any coach to try and get involved. I think some of my best memories coming through have been going through the academy program, or what's FDP now, and also with the under 12 Jamboree stuff. So I think on those days, it's a really good opportunity for you to just kind of dip your finger in and see if you actually like it or if it's where you want to be. And I feel like it's a really good opportunity to see, like, impact the kids in that region and just develop as a coach too, because I think that's something we do really well, is that academy FDP program. It's something that's worked for a long time now, especially on the countryside. It's something that we've done a lot of work on, and people in the past have put a lot of work and effort into that. And I think it's a great opportunity for any coach to get there and just kind of just get involved and help out and see if you like it.
Yeah, and I think the important part is, if you register to attend one of those, don't think that there is going to be a world of pressure on you to deliver all this content and everything that goes with it. There'll be a lead coach there on the day who will help you out with it. You might know them, you might not, if you're in that region, depending on what it looks like, but it is also a great opportunity to network with other coaches.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Like, it's probably one of the bigger opportunities, right? Like, you do get heaps of chances to coach kids, obviously talented kids as well, going to those Skills Days, but just the opportunity to get around coaches, especially for country coaches, you know, who don't get that opportunity, I think it's really beneficial as well, just to network, get their number and start chatting to them as well.
Yeah, it is. It is a genuinely fun day as well. And,
it's chaos.
Like, it is always chaos. There's a whole bunch of kids that all look the same running around with each other, and you're trying to look on their leg and, like, what number have you got? And it's like, because they're under 12 kids, they've got, like, the smallest legs in the world, and it's like one number's on one calf and the other number's on the other calf almost, like, trying to work out who's who.
Is it similar to what the Metro Skills Days used to be?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
very similar. I think they used to run them at Dandenong as well. Yeah, what was cool about it is, at the start of the day, they're all in their teams. I don't know if it's the same for country. And absolutely by the end of the day, they're all mixed up.
Yeah.
Yep. Like, that's the coolest thing that I used to see at those camps as well.
Still exactly the same.
Yeah,
like,
that's awesome.
And, you know, it would be, like, for Colac, for example, there'd be a whole bunch of kids from one town coming together. Mm-hmm. Like, it'd be those sorts of things as well. And, you know, they stick fairly tight all the way through. But I think from a coaching perspective, that's the fun stuff, is now you get to break them up into groups. And it's like, hey, go talk to that kid over there and find out what they're about and those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's some of the relationships I've built through them, like, even now, like, there's coaches that are coaching still that I met on those days.
Yep.
Even athletes, like, with the state teams I've coached last year, there was, like, four of them that I had at one of those days. So it's just really cool to be able to be a part of that. And, like, I think being able to go to a skills day, meet these kids, meet these people, and just kind of be involved with the community, which I think basketball does a really good job of.
Yep.
And we just need more people like that involved, and it's a really good opportunity to get there.
It is, and it is always fun. Like, it's, I mean, how many times do you sit there and go, man, I remember that kid under 12s.
Oh, like, yeah, it's multiple.
You know, and, like, all of a sudden they're making a state team, and it's like, wow, that's the same kid.
I took one to China last year, and he hit a game winner, and I'm just like, I can't believe I coached you in under 12s at a, like, skills day. It's crazy.
Yeah, it makes you feel old, doesn't it? Like, it's amazing how quickly basketball coaching can humble you as to your age. But that's kind of what it is. So I would always recommend have a little bit of a look at it. If you're unsure, that's fine. Like, there's no issue with that. But I think it is a great first step into coaching. Like, for those of you that are looking to do more in that space, I think the Skills Days is obviously a great example of that. The Under 12 Jamboree, you know, that's a phenomenal tournament. We've spoken at length about that previously, but that is also a great coach education opportunity for us to get amongst the coaches as well, but also for coaches to network and find out a little bit more. And, you know, a little bit of a common trend between this question and the last question, like the biggest thing for coaching is just network. Just ask questions. It's amazing how often people will respond to an email if you just like cold email them. Coaches reply to that stuff. And it's, you know, are they going to send you their entire playbook? Probably not. But if you ask questions about, hey, I've noticed that you've done this, you know, what can you tell me about that? What were the biggest learnings? Like, be genuinely curious about it. And it's amazing what comes back. Like, I remember I cold emailed tons of coaches. And I think there was like 35 or 40 when I was early on in my coaching. Like, I would have only been 20, 21 around that age at that point. And cold emailed about 30 to 35 coaches. It would have been, I reckon I got a response from about 26 of them. And the ones I didn't get a response on, you probably wouldn't expect to get one from. Like, they were very high up the chain.
It was like a wild card. Like, let's see if they respond.
Let's just see if Gorge comes back to this one. Like, it's those sorts of things. Like, ask the question. Like, find out from other people. And it's amazing. You'll see that same person at a tournament. It's like, hey, we worked at the skills days together. How's things going with this? What have you, like, those types of things. I think super valuable for coaches in that world. All right, this is a little bit of a curly one. Would you recommend moving up an age group with your child if they're bottom age to stay with their friends? Now, we can probably split this out into two different areas. Let's talk domestic first. So if it's domestic basketball, would you recommend like the whole team goes up to under 16s but your child's still in under 14s? Would you say move them out of there early in domestic? What do you got, Nick?
So we're moving them with the group.
Yeah, the whole group's going up.
The whole group's going up. Am I talking like a parent here? Sure. Is it? Yeah. Sure. No, I wouldn't.
Yep.
The fact on there's so many different teams, there's so many different selection periods. Yes, you want them to learn it later on, but it's a good opportunity to learn that as well. They're going to learn that they're still going to be their friends. They're just not playing on the team. Because it's going to get to a point where, hey, all my friends are in the first team, but I made the twos. Why can't I just play in the ones? Because you can't. So, like, it's, yeah, I wouldn't. Yep. Yeah, I'd leave it. Like, this is where you land. This is where you land. This is, you know, it's a system where it's like these are age group specific, and whether it's right or wrong, that's a system. And yeah, I wouldn't.
Yep. What about you, Brent?
I'm not a parent, so I can't really come from that perspective. But
I don't know. Parents give us coaching opinions all the time. It's only fair you give a parent.
I've got a 15-month-old. Don't worry. Like, people know. They're like, parent. What are you talking about, Nick?
I think Nick's on the right page with that. Like, there's obviously – it's like being in a school environment too. Like, you're not just going to put your child up to year eight just because all their friends are there. Like, there's just environments where you have to be able to do that. And, like, you're there for certain reasons. And then you – obviously, in your own social time – that's where you can be friends with them and you can go hang out with them and do those things. But I also see, like, there can be some pressures there with that stuff. Like, maybe the only way to get that child to play is to put them there, and that could be a different circumstance. So there's always, like, the depends, isn't it? Like, it really does depend on what's happening. And, like, just making sure whatever it is best for the child and best for everyone. Like, if there's a spot there and it's not going to impact anyone, I don't see it being an issue all the time, but it's just being careful of how much you give too. You just don't want to set that expectation.
Yeah, and I think there's a few things to take into consideration, and you've hit a couple of those too, Brenton. Are they moving up? And is it purely social? And, you know, understand if it is. But by staying down, that may give your child an opportunity to make different friends. And, you know, I think a diverse friend age group is actually a really good thing. If they go up and they're still young, do they get the leadership skills and qualities that they would if they stayed down and they were the leader of the next group coming through in that sort of space too? And I think a lot of the time kids don't know how to be the best at what they are. And I think by moving up with the group, that can actually hurt them a little bit because, you know, they experience the environment they're experiencing at the moment and nothing else. Whereas actually, I want to see if you can lead. Like, can you direct, or do you just take direction really well in that group and that cohort in that sort of space? So there's a few things I think to take into consideration with that. 12s to 14s, I'm probably not too concerned. 16s to 18s, I'm probably not too concerned. 14s to 16s, I'd probably recommend you stay. And that's just the physical maturation that goes on within those, you know, to be honest, with boys in particular, it feels like about 2 weeks they go from being, you know, 5'4" to 6'1".
That's
like,
true, yeah.
You know, the physical side of things, is it going to impact them physically? Yeah. Because if they can't compete at that level, it's going to be really difficult to get them motivated outside of the first 2 or 3 weeks when they're sort of pining for their old team and those sorts of things. you know, is there the possibility of playing two games? Like, you might be able to go up with that team but still stay within your age group and play two games in that, if we're talking domestic.
I remember I used to do that when I was back in Geelong. I used to play 16s and I'd go play 18s and then I'd go play men's during the week.
Yep.
But I think you've hit the nail on the head. You've got to try and keep them in their age group so they can develop those skills. Yeah. And, like, from my – I think I was at a school, Christian College in Geelong, and we used to have prep to two teams and grade, like, they had year levels, which was really good. I really liked it because prep to two, there was a 3-year where they could actually, like, stay in the team. You could put a group together. You could kind of move it around a bit more. It gave a bit more wriggle room. But I think, obviously the maturation, skill level stuff's really important. And that's, like, you can get into all that bio-banding stuff where, like, now we're creating a whole other layer to this. But I think socially it's just – it really is. At the young age groups, you probably can do it, but at the older ones, that's where it's going to become really difficult.
Yep. No, I don't disagree. What about on the rep side? Like, would you recommend people go up an age group early, or would you say stay where they are?
I think there's a time and place for it.
Yep.
Like, but also going back to that where you've got to learn how to be the best in your own age group. Like, you don't want to put them up there where they can't perform.
Yep.
But you want to challenge. So I think there is a time and place for it. Like, I'm not sure what – how old was Andrew Gaze when he played in the NBL?
Oh, probably 13.
Yeah.
Like, so Lindsay was coaching it. So, you know, that's straight
whatever
in.
He wanted.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it kind of worked with him going up, didn't it? Like, and I think there's – I can't remember the names, but I know a few other people it's worked with.
Yep.
But it's just – it goes back to that, isn't an appropriate challenge for them, or is it actually, like, within their development phase? Like, again, going back to teaching, like, is it – like, is it too much or is it not enough? So it's finding that balance, I think.
Yeah. I think it's an exception to the rule.
Yep.
It should be allowed, but I personally think it should only be allowed when they're physically just so much bigger than everyone else in the age group.
Yep.
Every other reason, I don't think they should move up.
Yep. That was going to be my question. Me. Like, is it a physical thing? Because, and we'll use 14s to 16s just for the sake of the argument. Like, if they stay in under 14s, they're going to be the biggest, most physically dominant player in the under-14s age group. They're not going to get challenged because no one else is their size or strength, and it doesn't actually get their skill set any better because they're just going to overpower everyone, in which case there's a fairly good case to be made for going up to 16s in that, because why wouldn't you? But the other part of it is, well, can they be played in different positions now than what they are currently playing in? And like, I remember having a player under 14 who was that physically dominant player. Like, no question. Bigger, stronger, all those sorts of things. I think they were only smaller than one player in that age group who was genuinely massive in that age group. But for us, we just played them as a wing. It's like, well, we're not going to play you in the post anymore. Like, we'll throw you in there occasionally. That's fine. Because ultimately, they probably were going to be more of a post player long term. But it's like, well, let's get you some reps on the wing. And can you coach them differently to challenge them where they're not being, you know, beat down on by going up an age group physically more than anything else, because, you know, positions don't always translate up age groups. And it's the usual rule of thumb is as you go from 14s to 16s, you probably go from a 5 to a 3, like up an age group but down two spots. That's difficult for a lot of players if the skill set doesn't line up with the maturation set.
I had the same thing with my 14s. Like, he would have had 30 kilos and probably 4 or 5 inches on everyone, but he stayed the same size as he went through. And I look back there, he's not actually playing anymore, right? Because he stayed the same size. He never adapted his game. Like, I look back with this question and I'd be like, yeah, he should go up and play out of position earlier.
Yep.
You know, because right now it's like, like for your example, we could play him in the wing, but he could just start backing guys down and from that's the wing.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? He'd just really go back to his strength and he would just go back into the post anyway. So, you know, taking that advantage away would really benefit. So in that instance, it would be, but it's an extreme example. Like these, you know, it's not common, but it is happening, right? We are seeing these athletes where we're like, far out, you're 15.
You know? Yeah. And I mean, the scary part is that I think as coaches, we can see the player and we look at them and go, hey, they're, you know, the size of an adult. So we treat them like an adult, forgetting that they're still kids, whether that be the skill set, whether that be the mental state, whatever it might be. And we can heap all these expectations onto them without necessarily – that aren't fair, for lack of a better way of putting it. Like, it's just not fair to expect a 14, 15-year-old kid to act like an adult just because they look like an adult. So it's also putting them in environments, and at the risk of going like full Darren Best here and just saying depends on all these questions, like there's an element of depends here, because every kid will be different. Like if they're the youngest child in their family, they probably are fairly well equipped to go and play up earlier because they're around older all the time. They know how to sort of handle themselves, for lack of a better way of putting it. Whereas if they're maybe the eldest child in their family and they're always the oldest, maybe they're not better served staying where they are in that age group. And it really is case by case. And, you know, I'd look at it and it's like, well, if we're going to look at what's best for the kid, where are they going to improve the most? Where are they going to have the most fun? Like, they're probably the two questions I'd be asking straight off the bat. And that might be, hey, the coach in the younger age group is actually really good. Like, we would be happy for them to leave them there, because that coach will know how to put them into different positions, to play well, to be tested, those types of things as well. So, yeah, it's not answering the question, unfortunately. But we've given you some food for thought, I'll suggest.
Yeah, think about it. Like,
yeah.
I would love to know the specifics of that scenario. That would help us answer the question a lot easier, because there's so many different variables that come into this as well, like what level you're at, what age group you're at.
Yeah, I mean, if we flip it to the girl side, like by the time you hit under 16s, most girls probably could go on play under 18s without too many problems. Like they are physically mature enough by that stage, and it's not unusual for us to see 15 and 16-year-olds playing in like youth league, playing, you know, reasonable minutes in either NBL 1 or Big V, because they are physically mature enough to go and do that, and they're ready to do that. So, you know, there's the other side of the coin as well. It's like, are you holding them back too much? Like, so they're not challenged.
It's pretty hard to do, because you've got to figure out the social side of things too. Like, and like, no one person's the same, as we all know. Yep. So I think that's a part of like the coaching. Like, it's actually fun to do that, is figure that out. Is that what they need? Is it what they not need? And I think as long as we're looking at what's best for the athlete or best for the child, and that's where it comes down to. It's like, are they socially ready for this? Okay, now can we do this? Are they able to do it? But it's giving them those little opportunities to stretch themselves that I think we don't do enough of.
Yep.
It's like, can you give that athlete opportunity to train with the NBL 1 team? Doesn't have to play, but then you can go back and be like, well, these are the things you notice. This is what you can work on now when you're playing against kids in your own age group. So I think just finding opportunities to kind of stretch them is really important. And then it doesn't have to be all in. It can be just little exposures to try and help them.
Yeah. And I mean, I've had this situation. I was coaching an under 18 girls team and there was an under 16 athlete that it's like, she would make my team. Like, comfort, she would make my team, no question. And sort of throw it out there. It's like, hey, you know, how about you play under 18s this year instead of under 16s? And unfortunately, her mum was the coach. So it's like, nope. Like, where I am, she is. It's like, yep, probably fair enough.
If you pulled that off, that would be the most impressive.
Would have been one of the greatest recruiting components of all time. And it was fair enough. And the reasoning behind it was not necessarily because she was coaching. It was because she always plays out of her age group. Like, because she was a physically mature athlete early, she always plays out. So she actually needs to experience what it's like to be, you know, the dominant kid in her age group, and how to lead and how not to just follow all the time. So there's a lot to unpack with that, and how you take that in, unfortunately. So maybe not completely answered, but we'll see how it takes off. The hard one is probably the next question. When would you recommend not coaching your own child? So Brenton? As the non-father in the room with myself, because we know Nick's coaching. Like the second Orlando's old,
you better believe it. Coaching. I'm already getting offers.
Oh, it's dangerous.
No, I think any opportunity you give your child to be able to be coached by someone else is probably the best way to do it, the best practice. But obviously that's not where we live in, and it's really hard to find coaches, and it's really hard to find people that want to like just be there and do the job, because it is a massive job that we do. It's a really loaded question, actually. I think that, yeah, any opportunity that you can, you don't have to do it.
Yep.
That's probably the best way to do it. But if you're going to do it, it's just making sure that you're communicating with your child, communicating with everyone involved, and making sure that you're just, because it can go one or either way, can't it? Yeah. It can either, we've all seen it where they go harder at their child or they go easier. It's not something that, it's just this way. It's always multiple different things that we see. But I think any opportunity where you don't have to coach a child, I think would be the best. But yeah.
Yeah. Better you than nobody.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's the reality of it. Yeah. Like, are you any different on that, Nick?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I would avoid it as much as possible. And the only reason is from my experience, and experience I don't mean as a parent, I mean as speaking to parent coaches, because they're the ones with the experience, not myself. I find that they find the most difficult thing is separating parent from coach, and they keep flipping back and forth. And that's really difficult because you're spot on. Like, most of the time, they're always way more critical on their child than anyone else. They're never usually like, oh, no, they're okay. I'll just really have a go at these other kids. It's always the other way around. And you may not see it either. So you may think, oh, no, that's not that parent coach. But go listen in the car, and I promise you that feedback session at the end of the game is still going.
Yep.
Right? So I would avoid it. I mean, the times that I would consider it, because I know, all jokes aside, I would avoid coaching Orlando as much as humanly possible.
Yep.
Because I've got to be, I don't know in my mind how I can be his coach and a dad. Yep. Like, I think they're two separate things, and I think they do clash a little bit as well.
Would that change if he wasn't playing basketball, for argument's sake? Like, would you be more open to it or less open to it, I suppose, if it was a different sport?
And I took that up and coach. No, I wouldn't, because I don't think it's the sport that's the thing that's making me restricted on it or making me question it. It's more the position that I'll be in. And I know how I coach with these kids and junior athletes. And it is different to being a parent as well, because there's some lines that you can't cross, obviously, because you're not the parent of these junior athletes. Whereas I think – I don't know how I would stop that if he was there, if that makes sense. I'd say there's better people than me, obviously, because they've clearly figured it out, or they're managing it and they're working it out, but they obviously have their issues and stuff. But for me, the only time I probably would coach his team is if he was a bit nervous to just take the first step and he was introducing to basketball, hey, I'll jump on the bench with you.
Yep.
Right, I'll coach, so you got me there, that's fine. Maybe I'm also a little bit reluctant just because there's a lot of players that play because they don't want to let the parent down.
Yep.
Or they feel that, even though the parent has never said it or felt that way, so I'm not implying that either. But I can see a lot of players on the court that probably don't want to play basketball, but they don't want to tell their parents they don't want to play basketball. And I don't want my son to be like that either. So that's why I would have issues. Like, I would coach another team, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know?
Just etiquette. Would you sort of not push him into basketball, but would you be sort of saying, hey, do you want to give this a crack? Or would you wait until he goes to you and says, I want to do this?
No, neither. So what I would say is the same thing my dad said to me, because my dad was actually soccer.
Yep.
It wasn't basketball at all. But he said, I don't care what you do, pick something, because you can't do nothing. And that's the same thing I'm going to tell Orlando. Like, I don't care what you do. I know we're on a basketball podcast, but like, at the end of the day, like, if he doesn't like it, why am I pushing him into it? So it would be pick something. And if he does three or four things and he's like, oh, actually it's this thing, then we'll stick with that. That's fine.
Yep.
So that's how I would approach it. I would let him choose and because I want him to be able to go, you know what, this isn't for me.
Yep.
That's what I want to get to. And sounds easy when I'm saying it out loud. I can imagine parents are pulling the hair out going, I got to call this guy and warn him what's coming.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's funny because obviously I don't have experience in this space, so I called a mate of mine who is a parent coach, and I'm like, why? Like, what's – like, when and where and how and those sorts of things. And he's like, look, to be honest, early on I was always, I'm not doing this. And then I sort of noticed it's like, look, I've actually got basketball experience. I feel like I could help out. But didn't want to overstep. Like, it was that kind of mentality with them. And it's like, look, my child's perfectly happy playing, but, you know, I felt like I could do more for them. So we started to do some stuff just around the house and the backyard and those types of things as well. And that was kind of their way of, you know, coaching without coaching in that space, because they were concerned about the car ride, the additional pressure, and has ended up coaching his child. He's like, but my theory was, I'm not going to coach until they ask me to coach. Like, and once they ask me, hey, can you coach my team? Now I'll go and do it in that sort of space, because it means they actually want me to in that world as well. So one thing he did say is, like, I'm acutely aware that I shaft my child more than any other child on that team, because the second it's a blowout and it's like, hey, let's just give everyone court time, he's like, invariably I screw up the sub somewhere and it's like, oh man, that, like, my rotations are all over the place. Who am I supposed to give this extra bit of court time to? I can't remember. Oh, I'll just take my child off because, you know, I'll deal with them because I can. Like, it's one person to be upset with me, which is my kid, and I can, you know, bribe them with Maccas or something on the way home and they'll forget about it pretty quickly. But, you know, if it's a child that's not yours, you're probably more likely to be a little bit more, you know, lenient in that space. Like, I did have story going way back, and it's we'll throw them. Okay, I hit the right button this time, so progress has been made.
No book time.
Exactly. So on that one, it was I was talking to a parent coach, and like the awards came in for the end of the year and all this sort of stuff, and I noticed that the parent coach had given their child MVP and just called them and said, hey, look, I'm not telling you no, but do you really want to do this? Like, this is maybe not the time to give your child MVP. I'm like, look, it's they might be the best kid, but, you know, give them another award or something like that. Just maybe don't make them. It was hell-bent on, no, we're giving them MVP. I'm like, all right, cool, no worries. We'll go down this path. And the parents mutinied. Like, it was a disastrous presentation night for that coach as well. And it's like, so if you are the coach, please don't give your child the award or try and find a different way around it. Like, I know I've done it in the past where I've had the players vote on the MVP and just sort of said, hey, you decide who it is and it'll be the player's MVP rather than the coach's MVP and those sorts of things. So just be mindful of that, because the last thing you want is the child coming up to accept their award with like, hey, you just gave me this because you had to type thing as well. So just be a little bit careful of that.
I think it's such a difficult job. Like, that's why it's so hard for me to even answer now. Yep. Like, when Orlando's this young, it's so I can only imagine, because when the game finishes, like, we all just get in the car, we feel sorry for ourselves and we call another coach and if it doesn't go well and we're angry and we vent and stuff, like, you're getting in the car and you can't do that. Like, I don't know how, you know what I mean? Like, you're sitting there and you go, well, I've got to sort my son or my daughter out now.
Well, sometimes you do.
Yeah.
Like, and sometimes they want to talk about it. And if they want to talk about it, talk.
Yeah.
Like, no problems. But I don't know that I project that on them either.
Yeah.
In the car right home. Like, I remember taking our niece to a game and, like, she played and all that sort of stuff. No worries. We jump in the car afterwards. And she's like, oh, we're going to talk about it? I'm like, I wasn't going to. Like, do you want to? She's like, yeah, I would. I was like, all right, well, let's dive in. Like, and we'll go with it from that end. But yeah, I definitely didn't want to instigate the conversation. Like,
I think that also just, I know we've said like we don't want to do it, but there are a lot of people that do it really well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, that's something, like, it's not something we're trying to say we don't want you to do.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah. It's personal opinion for me as well, right? Like, it's me personally. I'm not saying it's wrong. I actually like, that's why I'm ringing them for advice. Like,
Everyone's different, aren't they? And it's just like, there's people that do it really well, but like, I think some of the things like the awards and making sure you're comfortable with, they're the things you've got to be comfortable with. It can't just be, oh, don't do it. It's just whether you're comfortable. And I think the really one good one is about the child asking about coaching. Like, that's a really big one.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my take on it as well. It's like, actually, it's a really mature response. And like, this coach is a good coach. Like, you know, they know what they're doing. They would absolutely be of value as a coach. But until the kid wants them to, you know, maybe try not to if you can help it. Because I also like the idea of them having a different voice. Like, your child can access you wherever. But, you know, if you are in that situation where it's like, hey, I feel like I need to offer something, jump in as an assistant coach or grab another parent to assist you and have them coach your child so that you're not always the one having to give the feedback and the direction. Like, you're the same person telling them to, you know, put the dishes in the dishwasher and make their bed. So when you're telling them to help on split, it's just the message can get lost a little bit within there as well. So if you've got someone else that can help out and give them the task of, hey, can you coach my child? That'd be the perfect scenario, I think, in that sort of situation. Next one, how important is it to play at the VC level? Nick?
I don't think it's important.
Yep.
I don't. I think it's like, it's definitely a competitive, like the winning is a skill side. I can see where there's importance there. But in the scheme of things, if we're looking long term and whether or not you'll make it in 10, 15 years' time or whatever it is, I don't think it's as important. I don't know. I can't remember who won the VC championships last year.
Nope.
It definitely helps them with the competitive side. Which, but you can still
try them and still couldn't remember it. Like, I was legitimately thinking about that then, and I was like, I actually don't remember who won those last year.
Yeah,
like,
I can't. So it's,
I only remember the 18s because I was there.
Well, that'd probably do it
that's
for you.
The only
but yeah, that's kind that, of it.
That's the thing. Like, skill development's far. You can do skill development at any level. Not everyone played VC. I'm pretty sure Giddy didn't play VC one year in 16s. Yep. Or maybe
I've had multiple kids make state teams that aren't VC kids. Like, it happens continually.
Our best player in Wyndham in just before COVID never played a game of VJBL.
Yep.
Still remember it. And everyone's like, who's this kid?
Yep.
Just from Warrnambool, never played a game of VJBL and was arguably our best player at the tournament.
Casey DeWatt, was it?
Casey DeWatt, yeah. He was a Warrandyte kid.
Yep.
Tyler Robertson did eventually. But he was a Warrandyte kid as well.
Yeah.
All the way through. Sean McDonald.
Yep, Sean McDonald.
Was another one that did eventually play VC but wasn't at the time. Like, there's plenty of cases where it happens. Like, it's...
Yeah.
Development and talent happens regardless of the level.
I've never coached a VC team.
Yep.
That's, like, the crazy thing. Like, I keep looking back at it, and it's like, as a head coach, never been coached that level, but... Like I said before, with those kids I had in regional academies and things, like there was four of them in that state team last year. So it's just like, and they never played VC in under 12s or 14s. So I think going to what Nick said, it's more about the environment and making sure that you just continually get better and not worry about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice, don't get me wrong. Yeah. Like, I think most people would aspire to play it, but I mean, the country one's a really good example. Sometimes they live in places that don't have VJBL teams.
Mm. Yep.
So they still survive. Like, not being in that space. Like, some can logistically make it work. Like, the bigger associations in the country areas usually do play VC. So you might be able to link in with one of those. But I don't think it's the be all and end all. I mean, it absolutely isn't as a bottom age kid. There's kids in the
Melbourne and Kilsyth Youth League and NBL 1 teams who are like 12-5s, 14-6s, 16-3. And they've just gone through the age group, developed their craft. They've been around good people. And it's translated. Like, there's all these players coming through. They were sitting and they were patient and they wait. That's the big thing. I think the whole, do I need to play VC now, is the same thing. Like, I need 3 skills trainers to get up to speed quickly. Well, you're not going to be a pro player at 13. So you don't. Like, you need to be patient. You need to understand that your best basketball is probably going to be at 23 years old. Hopefully, if you've done everything right, like, you're peaking at 23, not 13.
Yeah, there aren't too many great basketballers that peak at 13 that go on to be great basketballers. Let's face it. Like, it's you know, size and all those sorts of things play a part in that. But, yeah, I'd certainly not be too stressed by it. And especially in the older age groups anyway, you play with a shot clock in other grades that aren't VC. So I wouldn't worry about it too much personally. Like, I think it's nice to aspire to. But if you miss out, it's like, oh, we missed out.
Yeah, and I think... if you're going to be trying to move to get to a VC club, I don't think that's always the right thing to be doing.
Yep.
Like, I look at some kids, it's like, if you're at a club and you started in Metro 4 or VJBL 4 and now you're in VJ1, that's improvement, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And I know there was a couple of girls I had at Maribyrnong that played at Westgate, and I'm pretty sure when they come in under 14s, they were in VJL 6. Yep. Top age 18s, they made VC reserve. Yep. Like, that's really cool to see. And, like, that was one of probably my biggest successes at the school was – seeing those two girls really improve and get to that level and, like, make SDP and do all these things. And when they're under 14s, like, they were probably not the first two we picked for the program. So, it'd be more about the development side, isn't it? And who's coaching and is it a good environment for my child? That's more important than, oh, I need to move to one of these VC teams because in the end it comes down to their development, not actually what level they're playing at all the time.
100%, and with that, that's in the same category as moving up in an age group as well, in my opinion. It's like, you can show leadership at your club, or you can join these quote-unquote super teams. Like, what's your responsibility in that team now? Like, think about your own development as well, not just the simple thing of VC titles. Of course you aspire to them. Of course you want to win. That's what a competitive spirit's about. But I don't know. I just find it the easy way out. Like, I don't know how else to word it. I just find it when teams load up like that and they're super good. And I'm no saint. Like, I had one, right? Like, it is the easy way out. It really is. You don't develop. Like, no one gets any better that year.
Well, it's not because the argument is always with the super team type stuff. Oh, but their trainings are so much better. Occasionally they might be. Mm. You're right. Like, when you can get all 10 kids there and you can go 5-on-5 and you can figure it out. But by and large, because they're not getting tested on a Friday night, they're not getting pushed. Like, where's the incentive for them to get better? And that's the hard part. Like, until they cop a little bit of a hiding or something like that, they're not going to really see, oh, that's what the coach is talking about. These are the deficiencies and the flaws. Like, and that's, like, it's something that we always did with our state team, a little bit of a different context, but we would always go and play McKinnon's Youth League men's team, like, with their under 16s. And every time they would smoke us. Like, and it was like, there were times where it was 40 to 50 points. Like, they would absolutely belt us. Mm. But it was perfect. It's like, hey, now we can learn from this and we can go and figure it out from here. Because, and I think it got closer over the 3 years. Like, the first year we did it, we got royally smacked. There were times we weren't even getting the ball over half court. Like, there was, it was bad. By the third year that we brought a group through, they'd kind of been better prepared for it. Yep. And so it helped me for a start in that sort of space. But I think you want to be challenged. Mm-hmm. And whatever you get challenged at, well, that's fine. But there's no point in just, you know, loading up the Xbox and putting it on very easy. Like, it's, you know, go and put it on something that's going to make you work and motivate you to go and get better in that space. So it does link in with our next question, though, which is, should you push for a higher grade or drop into an easier grade when you're going through grading? And, you know, again, we'll preface this with depends, of course, as we go through it. But where do you sort of sit with it, Brent?
I think it, like, an example that I have is when I was back in Geelong coaching under 16 girls, and I, like, we probably could have made VC that year, but we didn't. And I think it was probably the best experience for that group, just for where they were at in their development. And it wasn't that we didn't try to get there, but I think, going back to that, like, VC, should you move to go somewhere for VC? It's like, no, you need to be in the appropriate environment for your challenge and whether you're being stretched enough and whether you're getting what you need out of it. So obviously you want to try and play at the highest level. And I think if we're looking at it from a high performance lens, that's what we're trying to do. But there's way more to basketball than high performance. Like, it's someone told me not long ago, it's like, you need to coach every athlete like they're going to be a professional, knowing that 99.9% of them aren't going to be. So it's just, how do we cater for that 99.9%? And that's what we've got to really, I think, take into account, is like, what's going to make this the best experience for these people and the coaches and the parents and everyone involved, and how do we keep them in basketball? Because one day they might be a referee, they might be a coach, they might be just someone who supports basketball, which is what we need. And I think, yeah, we kind of lose the sight of what's most important at times when it comes to junior basketball, which is, and I'm guilty of it all the time. We're always, always trying to, like, we want to be the best, we want to do this, we want to do that. But it's, how do we cater for the majority? And it's, how do we make sure that, like, that group of girls that I had the best experience, so the next year they kept playing basketball or they become better people or those kind of things.
Yeah, and it's funny because I remember at one of the clubs I was at, a second team made VC before Christmas, which is very unusual. Like, that doesn't normally happen at most associations. So everyone sort of thought, hey, this is going to be a great year. Like, yeah, twos have made VC and all that sort of stuff. 0 and 20 over the course of the year. Like, didn't win a game. And that was demoralizing, and it was really hard to get them back the next season. And it probably depends a little bit on if they're top and bottom age. Because if they're bottom age and they can play upper level, yeah, test them. Because, you know, there's, you know, the whole iron sharpens iron type thing. Like, they will get better because of it. But if they're top age kids and you sort of notice, hey, the motivation may not really be here with this group of kids to really be motivated to get lots better and stay in the sport and those sorts of things, maybe you are better off dropping back and just sort of saying, hey, we're going to enjoy this and we're going to actually make, not that we should never do it, but we're going to make fun the genuine priority in this team, where I can manipulate games a little bit more. I can put people in different positions where, you know, they are going to get tested a little bit. Like, you can do that. And it's very rare. Like, and I've been through it as well. Like, in particular, when I was coaching, like, under 12 teams, it's like, I always wanted to try and play as high as I possibly could when they were bottom age. And then from their top age, they can work out where they fit within all that. But my thing was, I felt like I was a good enough communicator and motivator to keep their head above water. Like, yeah, they'd lose games to bigger, stronger and all that sort of stuff, but I was okay at keeping them motivated in that space. But I also wasn't worried about wins and losses. Like, and that's the big thing, is that, are we only worried about the wins and losses, or are we working with what's best for the kid?
Yeah, that's why I was going to say as well, it's a bit different to Brendan about moving up a grade, because I would go up even if it is 0 and 20, because the measurements won't be wins and losses. And I know it will be for those athletes. I get that. But the communication, being clear with the path, being clear about what's happening in the next few years, what you've achieved already is amazing. Let's build on this. Let's close gaps on games. That's how I would address it. Like, how are we defending? Like, you know what I mean? Like, the communication around it throughout the season is important. But I don't know. I'm not the type of person that would allow them to drop just so they can get closer games. If they deserve to go up and it's a significant jump, well, it's my job as a coach to close that gap. That's how I feel about it anyway. Like, it's my job to – I've picked this team. They've succeeded in moving into this grade. It's now my job to close this gap. It's the same analogy as the starting five and the bench. They're never as good as each other, But what your job is to get them as close together as possible, right, at the end of the day. And I think that's the same with if you go up in the grade, especially if you're Junior League 1 into VC. Yep. Like the 0 and 20, it happens.
Yeah,
I think I actually played on a team where I was at the 2.
0 and 20?
No, I think it was like 2 and 18 or something like that. But it wasn't good. But like we got a lot out of it. Like it's we played really good teams. Most of us played in the youth league team, you know, a few years later. So we definitely benefited from it. And also this age or this current generation is – you know, we talk about the VC, but it's like if I'm not in VC, I'm out. So, like, having a team in VC as well does help associations because it helps retain some of these players that they've developed for the last 5 or 6 years and they don't bail to some other club either.
Yep. And I think the hard part is most coaches would look at their team and it's like, well, look, you know, maybe my starting five is capable of playing higher, but my next five probably aren't.
Mm.
And it's like, well, okay, well, you know, the answer is not, well, I'm just going to play my best five if we go up a grade and I'm just going to shelve the bench. That doesn't help the solution either. So, I would certainly caution against tanking games to go down. Like, I absolutely would not be doing that. But, you know, I'm kind of one of those people that's just, hey, the cards fall where the cards fall. Like, yeah, you want to win games, like, but whatever grade we end up with, we end up with. And very rarely does a team go undefeated, and very rarely does a team not win a game. So you'll experience some ebbs and flows, I think, over the
especially now that VC and VC Reserve
split.
Yeah, correct, yeah, right? Like, yeah. It's bigger. It used to be just 10 teams.
Yeah, it was brutal.
That's when I was at that, and we got 2 wins out of that. So.
Yeah. No, it was rough. I remember, you know, back in the day, and you know, there's obviously cases to be made for does it need to be reviewed and all that sort of stuff. We're not the people to do that for you, but, you know, there are a strong cases to be made for, you know, do you go back to, like, the 10 teams sort of stuff? Because, man, those games on a Friday night were brutal. Like, it's every week you played someone that could
tough league, like, wasn't
it? Yeah. That was hard. Whereas, obviously, now more kids get an opportunity to experience it and see it and those sorts of things. So there's benefit to that as well. So there's pros and cons to both. But, yeah, it has changed the landscape a little bit over the course as well. How would you balance between calling a timeout to stop momentum and allowing your players to figure it out? And this is the utopian question. Like, it's
far out.
This is tough. Like, I'm acutely aware that, and again, it's not a one size fits all approach. I'll give you.
I got questions to follow up on.
No, that's fine. I'll give you mine to start off with. I'm probably more the coach that will let them figure out on offense. Like, if things aren't going well on offense, I'm probably less likely to call the timeout. And I'm probably more likely to give them some autonomy in that space to work out what's going on. But I am absolutely more likely to call it if the defense is wrong on our end or isn't where it should be to stop momentum. That's just a personal thing. I think that's just how I'm wired with how I look at the game in general. I tend to be more on the defensive end than I do the offensive end. So I want control because I do like the idea of giving players autonomy to trial and error learn to figure it out for themselves. I do like that side of things. Sometimes they just need reminders. Yeah. And that's the hard part is I think this comes from, in particular, are you trying to win or not? Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not telling you can't try and win games as a coach. Obviously, that is a big part of what we're there for and those sorts of things. But it shouldn't replace player development. Mm-hmm. That's my sort of thing. So if I'm looking at this with a senior lens, and when I say seniors, under 18s into senior basketball, then, yeah, I'm probably calling the timeout the second it looks like it's going to go pear-shaped. But juniors, I'm probably letting it go a little bit more. And it's like, hey, you've got to be in this position before I'm going to come in and save you, so to speak. I am notorious for not calling timeouts in games in junior basketball. Like, this is part of my DNA to the point where, like, I don't
remember.
Yeah, I know. Like, I had an ongoing conversation with a coach, actually, and I won't out the coach because, you know, they're still very much involved with the basketball pathway. And it's like, we were both coming out of the classic weekend. Our teams were sort of broken and bruised and all those sorts of things. And it's like, hey, no timeouts tonight? And they're like, nah, no timeouts tonight. I'm like, ripper. And then it got close down the stretch and it was their ball on the sideline. I looked down the other end and, like, they were itching to call the timeout. I'm like, don't you do it. Don't you do it. Don't you do it. And they called the timeout. I'm like, Jesus. Trying to get out of here earlier tonight. Like, we just need to get out without any more injuries. Like, I tend not to call timeouts. That's just kind of how I coach junior basketball. I try to coach more stuff on the fly and with subs and feedback on that end. But again, that's a personal preference. Both of you two look mighty uncomfortable trying to come up with an answer of this.
Do you want to go first or do you want me
I've just got a question for both of you. Like, how much is yours feel? Like, a feel for what you're feeling at that moment in time? Or is it a number?
Mine's a number. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. So mine's defensively as well. Same thing. But general rule is about three scores in a row is a timeout, right? If it's two stop and a score, it's probably a rotation or it's a swap the matchup, something like that.
Yep.
But if it's three in a row straight up, I'm hitting a timeout.
Yeah, see, I'm not. Mm. Like, I am more feel because it's like, hey, if we're getting really good shots down that end but they're just missing, what am I going to say at that timeout that's really going to adjust anything?
Mm.
And look, if we're hemorrhaging points down that end, I'm probably calling the timeout, but for different reasons anyway. Yeah. So, but yeah, I tend to be more gut feel. And I was talking to a coach at Southern Cross actually about it who gave up, I think it was three buckets in a row without getting a good look down the other end and called the timeout to the bench. Bench missed it, whatever. That doesn't really matter too much. But then they got a stop on defense and got a score and I canceled the timeout. It's like, no. The problems that were there are still there. Like, you still need the timeout. Like, if you're trying to address something, you still need that timeout. Just because you've scored doesn't absolve all the issues that you've had. So I tend to be more feel of the game. And it's like, look, if we're getting good shots and we're doing a pretty good job defensively, like someone banks two threes in a row or something like that, it's like, hey, you know, what's a timeout going to do in this situation? Like,
but it's VJBL, so if it's the same kid,
well,
I'm still calling it. Like, some of the shots they hit consistently is wild.
Yeah. I have been absolutely pummeled by things like that. I still remember a youth league game where a guy averaged 2 points a game, and I'm pretty sure he's coaching in Big V now.
Yep.
And he had 30 on us because I said, oh, we're going to let him shoot. And he hit three bank threes at the start of the game. Yep. And I let it keep going and he didn't miss from there.
Well, that's just more unlucky than bad management. Yeah. Like but that happens.
Yeah.
Like it does. You know, and that's the challenge, I suppose. It depends on the age group you're coaching. Like young kids, let them figure it out. Older kids where winning is a genuine thing, you got to probably impact it a little bit more, I'd suggest.
I just think no matter what the scenario, three scores in a row – if you don't stop that bleeding, like the game could be done.
Yeah, it could be, but it's only two possessions and you could be tied again.
Yeah,
exactly right.
I've had.
I agree with you, but my opinion is
like,
for the same argument. Yeah. I agree.
I think I look at what I've done in the past, and like I feel like with juniors, I've been harder on that than I have with seniors.
Yep.
Or the older they get, and it's usually been I'm really feel. But then poor Nando, like he comes up to me every time. He's like, says, "What's the run?" Because I remember at Nationals last year, I'd always turn him, what's the run? And it's like ingrained in his head now. But it's just, like, I like to know what the run is, but that's never really dictating whether I'm calling it or not. And I think it's just a feel thing for me, whether is it being done the right way or is it being done the wrong way. I've called timeouts where we've scored three times in a row, but there have been three horrific shots.
Yep.
And it's been from three different kids. Like, or it's like, okay, that guy's off. It happens again, now we're off. I still remember losing to Kilsyth with that under-12 team because one of the players hit two threes, and then another player hit a three, and we got up by a point, and I called a timeout. And I'm like, what are we doing? And I vividly remember it, and I dragged them out at that time too because I thought it was a really important moment to teach the kids, like, is that a good shot or is it a bad shot? What are we trying to do here? Like, how are we trying to score? How are we trying to defend? Are we indeed trans properly? And then we lost by about 10, but I still remember, like, one of those kids come up to me not long ago and still remembers that.
Yep.
But it's just timeouts are – yeah, I'm really all over the place with them now that I think about it. It's like, it's just a feel thing for me.
That's my thing. Like, it is feel. And look, there are points in the scoreboard where it gets, like, bad, and it's like, hey, we don't have a choice here. Like, I absolutely remember in Nationals where we went down, I think, 15-2, and I didn't have a timeout. And it's like, well, I kind of felt like we were getting good shots.
Is that the New Zealand game?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, that was a good game.
Yeah.
Can you go back and watch that? Is that somewhere?
It might be on YouTube somewhere.
That was an unreal game. Because you were down by more than 15.
I know, we were down by 22 at the half.
Yeah, it was
and I'm putting that down solely to bad coaching, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
It was not good.
Yeah.
But it really was. Like, I look back on it, it's like, yeah, I probably should have had a timeout there, like on reflection. But at the time, I didn't think I needed it. And you're all, like, as coaches, we are always the eternal optimist. It's like, oh, but yeah, just one good possession here will fix the problem and I won't need to call that and those sorts of things. It's like, no, problems are problems. Mm. You've got to fix the problems. And sometimes you do want to get to that point where I think if you've been trying to address a problem over an extended period of time and you're not getting the buy-in or whatever the case might be, I'm probably more inclined to just let that roll. And it's like, hey, you know what? I've tried to tell you.
Yep.
You need to see the repercussions of this because I keep stopping this from happening. Which is part of your job as a coach, but again, I'm talking younger age groups.
Yep.
I keep stopping this from happening, so you never really feel the repercussions of poor shot selection, not getting back on D-trans, rotating off a corner, those sorts of things, because I keep stopping it from happening. Mm. at this point in time, you need to experience what this feels like when we don't do it properly. And then all of a sudden, it's amazing how big a motivator. It's like, oh, now I get it.
Yeah.
Like when they see it and they feel it, now I actually get what you're talking about. And so there are times where I would absolutely do it. And it's, you know, is it a game that doesn't matter? Is it like the last game before finals? You've lost one game all year and the team you're playing against doesn't really matter. That might be a really good time to teach some lessons like to some players. And it's like, hey, we need to lose one here and just sort of perk us up a little bit before finals, or, you know, figure out our rotations to be different. But yeah, I tend to be a let it ride more often than not.
Do you make changes before the timeout though? Because I feel like a timeout's more like, you know, you break the glass in case of emergency, you know what I mean? Yeah, you're pulling the fire alarm. But before that, you're changing stuff beforehand. Like I think it needs a bit more context than
I've called one like two possessions in.
Yep.
Just because
I did that a couple of weeks ago.
I
broke my golden three scores in a row rule.
I vividly remember this one player letting someone and like didn't stick to the scout, and I'm just, and we needed this player to play. Like so that's where it is different at that level. But yeah, it's I feel like I see where you're coming from now. Like it's, you do have to kind of have that. The players need to know, like, where's the line too, so they're, okay, we can fix this, oh, now we can't. We've got to go back there. So there's a lot of different circumstances, isn't there? But, yeah, you know, I wish I had an answer.
Yeah, well, and it genuinely is, I think, age group specific.
Yeah.
Like, if you're a team that wants to make VC, you're in the last crossover game to get into VC, well, I'm absolutely calling the timeout to try and get in there and try and get the kids the opportunity to play at that level because that's what they want to do. If it's a game where it's like, no, teachable moment, like this is one we're all going to have to sit in, and it's like, hey, warned you guys.
Yeah, so like, you call more closer to 18s?
Yeah, I would.
And less down, because it makes a good point. Like I've coached predominantly, my junior coaching was 14s, and that's the Wild West for me. That's
the chaos. Yeah.
You could be up 18 at the end of the third and lose by 10.
Yeah.
Like that's how crazy like
it is. It and is, that's yeah. So yeah, I think it's a little bit of a horses for courses type thing in that sort of world. All right, so this is, a very loaded question as to which direction we go in here, and I'm conscious of time. Zones in junior age groups. Where are we at? Brenton, we'll go you first.
Yeah, just you probably want to
give some time to stew over in the corner there.
A really influential coach on me, actually, Al Westo, said it to me once. I complained about someone zoning me, and he's going, Brenton, it's a part of the game. And I still remember going, wow, he's probably right about that. It's a part of the game that we're going to have to deal with, and we have to expose the athletes to it. My whole philosophy on it is I would rather not do it, but I've also been guilty of going to a nationals and doing it, and it's worked. So it's just one of those things like when you're in junior basketball, is it hiding a deficiency that needs to be fixed, or is it something that you're doing as a scheme because they can do the other things? So you can't skip steps with that. It's because good zone, do you watch Syracuse when they were really good in their zone stuff? It's because they could actually defend. Like they were still defending one-on-one. They were still closing out properly. They still had ball screen schemes. They had all these different things inside of it. It wasn't just stand there. And I feel like that's where we get to. It's like, oh, we can't defend, so now we're going to play a zone. I think that needs to get chucked in the bin. That needs to not be a part of junior basketball. But if there's a reason why we do it, like we were just talking about it then in the office about, is there an opportunity where out of timeouts, maybe we do go to a zone straight out of a timeout because that's where our coaches can get a rep against and the players can, and it's a bit more controlled. But then the rest of the game, you have to be man-to-man. So it's just how do we control that better? And I think watching basketball at the moment, I was sitting with a coach who coaches in the NBL not long ago at the Eltham Dandenong tournament.
Yep.
And we're watching a New Zealand team play, and his first comment was, everyone here plays zone. And that's crazy. Like, he's American, this guy, and... Yep. He's just like, it's just crazy how much zone's played here. And I think we're hiding too many deficiencies. So I would say it probably doesn't have a massive part, but there still is a part it has to play.
Yeah, I don't think we help by shelving it completely.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and we had the discussion maybe only a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about Southern Cross. And I think I was actually the one that put my head in the noose on that one and sort of said, look, maybe we should let teams play zones in 15s. I think I said 15s in the first half.
Yep.
I think was my sort of thing. It's like, well, let them play zone. Like, they're going to have to see it in that age group anyway, like let them get exposed to it early so that when they get into 16s, it's not a shock because it's going to get played internationally. It's going to get played, you know, at various stages. So the balance is probably a little bit more zone than matchup for me at the moment. Like I think there is still probably a little bit too much zone. But I think, and you hit on the point, I think if you're going to it as a change up tactically, yes. If you're doing it to hide stuff because there's one player that can't defend or something like that, that's where I'm out. Like, that's your job. Like, get them better.
Yeah, and I think with that, like, an example for us was Saar when we had him.
Yeah.
Like, that's a different story. He's 7 foot something. We had to kind of play zones like that to so he could play.
Yep.
Because he's never going to be able to do, like, guard on the perimeter all the time or switch out and do these kind of things. So, but when you've got a 6 foot six kid there, they have to be able to defend if they want to play at whatever level they're going to be playing at. So, yep. I completely agree.
I like some parameters around it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because the hard part is, and I've seen this at a couple of associations, and I'm pro them trying something different. I just don't know that it completely works. Is if the margin's more than 20 points, you have to go back into a zone. It's like, well, actually, it's probably going to be harder to score against that for the other team than it will be easier. Like, I get what you're doing in trying to take the pressure off being up the floor, so I commend them in that. But sitting in a zone probably takes away all their driving lanes. It's going to force perimeter shots. It's going to end up in layups going the other way. So I don't know that it quite hits.
Yeah,
in
and that how many times do you see, like, I teaching a zone? Like, it's.
Yep.
A zone isn't just something you go, oh, we're going to play 2-3 stand in these spots. Like,
yep.
That's what But that's what I was going to say, right? Like, I coached against Zach Malt and Al McCautry.
Yep.
And they, after a timeout, they walked out and set up in a 2-3 zone.
Yep.
It was youth league game. And they said, oh, they're in a 2-3 zone. I go, this won't be a normal 2-3 zone. This will be well thought out, well taught, and they'll know their rotations. This is not something they've just done off a whiteboard, and it was really good, like the way they rotated out of it and everything. It was actually really impressive. I think zones are fine in the game provided that it is taught, but unfortunately 90% of them aren't. I think at a junior level it's an issue for me when you're just sticking them in a zone because they can't shoot the three ball or they're not tall enough to shoot over them and those sorts of things. That's where I have an issue. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be in there for 16s and 18s. I think it needs to be because, it is, like you said, it's part of the game. You've got to figure out how to attack it. Like, it's very different to attacking man-to-man. But if you are going to use it, you need to teach it. And if you don't teach it, it's because you don't know it, so don't use it until you've learnt it. Like, I just think it's that simple. Where are the rotation points? Like, where are the weak points in the zone that you have to cover up? Like, I think that part is missing, and that's probably the part that frustrates me. I'm not a great zone coach either, so I won't preach that I am. So I'm constantly learning. It's definitely an area that I'm always trying to expand my knowledge and things like that as well. But if it's a quick fix, I have an issue with it. If it's part of a change up, I don't.
Yep.
We did that for, I think it was what year were, I'm trying to think. It was the first year in Brisbane, I think it was, for 18s. And
yep, it's been there 3 years now. So yeah. It must have been 2022.
Yeah, so that group there, we spent a lot of time teaching zones, like, because we knew we had to. We were going to play against Queensland South that had Roman and Rocco, and we had no other, like, solution for them because we were tiny. And then same with a couple of the other teams, like Vic Metro, we had to do the same thing, but obviously we know what happened in the gold medal game that day. But I think when we did that, it was kind of like, it was really good for me and my development and teaching it properly, but we used it as a change-up. Like, it was like we had a box in one, we had a triangle in two, we had a 1-2-2, and then we had like a slider zone, but they were all based around really similar principles. It was just different how it looked. But it took a lot of time to teach. Like, it was like how much time you have to spend on your man-to-man defense. And that's, like Nick said, if you can't teach it. But it was a really good experience for me, and it worked for us that year. The year after, we tried to do the same thing, it didn't work. So it's all group-dependent, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I think there's part of it too where, and I still remember, like, hey, we're in a timeout, things weren't going well, and say, hey, we're going to go to a 2-3 zone, and all the heads drop straight away. Mm. And it's almost that defeatist attitude of, oh, we can't guard this. We know we have to go to a zone here.
There is that everywhere at the moment, isn't there?
Yeah, I feel like there is. And so if you are going to play zone, and again, different times and situations it calls for it, teach it and make it a scheme that they buy into. Mm. It's like, oh, cool. Okay, we get to do this now. We're going to rotate off this. We're going to trap over there. This is how this is going to look. That inspires a little bit of motivation, I think, for players. Not just the, hey, we're just going to wave the white flag and hope for the best on this one. So I think if it's something that's taught, it's something your players can buy into.
Yeah. Do you know where that impression comes from, where they get deflated? You've probably spoken to the coaches and you go, how'd you go Friday? I go, oh, he freaking zoned me. You know what I mean? And the kids here, they go, don't worry about it, fellas, or don't worry about it, girls. Like, you know, they just zoned us to win. Yeah. So, like, I don't agree with that either, like, with that terminology. Like, figure out ways to beat the zone is where you should be coming, not say, oh, don't worry, they did this, like you know.
And the way to beat zone is you just turf up threes and hope for the best, isn't it? Like, it's volume over everything else. Like, it's don't worry about post-play.
Pick 10 shooters and go for it, baby.
Just get stops and you'll be fine.
Genuinely. Like, it is one of those things where it's like, just give me a high-low look. Like, hit the high posts, find the post, low post, lay up, life's good.
I was speaking to a coach. You know what he does? He wasn't good in the half-court zone. So every time he saw a zone, he just started pressing them to try and get turnovers and play in transition as much as he can. So he would just throw, like, 2-2-1s and you know, run and jump man and just kept it junky so they couldn't get into the zone.
Yep. Don't mind it.
It's a Rod Boone 101 right there.
Yeah.
I remember him telling me that. Another throwback. As soon as someone goes to a zone, run. Go, beat them down the floor. So get stops, run.
There's something to it.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's something we're not very good at here, is how do we actually beat a zone?
Yeah.
So this is where we can't just throw it out, can we? We need to be able to...
Oh, we need to have it in.
Yeah.
Like, I think it is a valuable part of the game, to be perfectly honest.
Big time.
That wraps up our questions. We just got Social Split Talk on the other end.
Toast on Facebook. Let's go.
It's like me on Twitter.
This one from Sean McVay, who is the head coach of the LA Rams.
My advice to coaches, simply be reminded by asking this question to yourself. Would you want to be coached by you? Would you want to be coached by you? If you're really doing it at a high level as a coach, man, what a powerful platform that is to have, or to be a teammate in a leadership role. I think the best leaders, they impact and influence positive change while also knowing that they're human too. Like, give yourself some grace in the midst of the journey. But for coaches, the appropriate perspective is ask yourself, would you want to be coached by you?
A little bit of a fade out on that one. I actually remembered to take the bad part out of it. Yeah. Really valuable check-in for coaches, I think, more than anything else, is, you know, would you be happy with your behavior, your instruction, your motivational tactic, whatever the case might be? Would you want that? Now, valuable check-in, but just because you would doesn't mean everyone does as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just a nice little review tool as to where am I actually at with my coaching? Have I deviated off what my coaching philosophy is? Where am I at with it? I just think it's a nice little reminder. And, you know, would one of your mentors be proud of how you're coaching this? Like, that is an easy check-in, I think, for coaches to have. And, you know, it's just a genuine review of where are you at with it. And not everyone will be on the same path and all those sorts of things. Like, everyone will do things slightly differently on that. But have a genuine consideration. It's like, would I be happy to play for me at the moment? And if it's no, figure out why. And make some adjustments to it and hold yourself accountable to those adjustments. Like, everyone will be slightly different. Some will say, hey, I was too negative in this game. Some will be, I actually didn't hold them accountable enough in this game. That's fine. But what would you expect and what would you stand for in that space? And I think that's where the challenge is for a lot of coaches, is that we can deviate off that path. We can try and emulate other people and how they coach. Like, those types of things can be dangerous, I think, for coaches. So trying to find the value add as to, are you what you think you are in that space?
And that question has to be meaningful as well. Otherwise, it's no impact. Like, you can't go, yep, I would. Yep. You know, would you? Why then?
Yeah.
Like, that's the next question. Why?
Yeah, or what's missing?
Yeah.
Like, that's a valuable part of it. So for those that sent in questions, thank you very much. There's a whole bunch of other questions we didn't get to today, so we'll do another mailbag somewhere down the road and come back to those ones. Nick, Brenton, thank you guys for jumping in on this one. Greatly appreciated. I'll try and hit the outro button and not need a mashing pad for the buttons in the future, and we'll see how we go. But coaches, we'll catch you all again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.